It is October the 5th. More importantly, it is the sixth day of the Tishrei, which is the sixth day of Esrei Simei Tshuva. It's actually turning into the seventh right now, which is getting pretty close to Yom Kippur. Yeah. Okay. So we are on page 176, continuing with Parshas Vayishlach. Last time we had a discussion that really went back to Parshas Toldos and a little bit of Vayetze in the beginning of Vayishlach. We talked about Rosh Hashanah in depth and how it ties into the whole story with Yaakov and Lavan. And we said then that the Zohar seems to indicate, although I don't know if this is 100% accurate, but it seems to indicate that the the Zohar seems to indicate that this encounter between Yaakov and Esav takes place on Yom Kippur itself, which means that the battle between Yaakov and the angel, which we just spoke about, which is the previous night, it would also be on Yom Kippur. That's what is implied by the Zohar. I don't want to say that definitively because it did not read that clearly. It's not like he said it was Yom Kippur, but that was the implication. And certainly, he definitely connects this episode with Yom Kippur. Whether it actually happened in Yom Kippur, I can't say for sure. So we are up to Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 31.
You mean battle with the angel or meeting with the angel?
Well, they're both the same day. The nighttime was with the angel. The daytime, we haven't read yet, but it's going to be Esau. That's the same time. Vayikra Yaakov Shema Makom Peniel. Yaakov called the place Peniel. Why did he call the place Peniel? Ki ra'isi Elokim panim el panim. For I saw Elokim face to face. Vati natzel nafshi. And my soul was saved. So Peniel is a contraction of Penei Kel, the face of God. So apparently he was awestruck by having seen the angel and having been saved from the angel, and so he names it Peniel. Vayizachlo Hashemesh, the sun rose for him, Kasher Avares Penuel, when he passed Penuel. So before it said Peniel, now it says Penuel. It's the same place. The simple meaning is that words sometimes will change depending on their placement in the sentence. A small change like that from a yud to a vav is not a significant change. Sometimes that will happen depending on where you find it in the sentence. Obviously, there's a deeper meaning to it, but that is the simple meaning. V'hut solea al yirecho, and he, literally this is in the present tense, he is limping on his hip. Al-Kain, because remember, that's where the angel touched him. Al-Kain, therefore, lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael esgid hanasheh. The b'nei Yisrael do not eat the gid hanasheh. The gid is the sinew hanasheh that moved, because when the angel touched him and that on the hip, he knocked it out of place. So the Jews do not eat the gid hanasheh. Asher kaf hayarech, that is on the hip. The kaf means, a kaf means a spoon. So the round part of the hip, ad hayom hazeh, until this day, kinaga b'chaf yerech Yaakov, for he touched the hip of Yaakov. How do they translate kaf yerech? For he touched the hip socket of Yaakov, begid hanasheh, on the displaced sinew. They're right. Okay, we're going to stop here and examine these psukim a little bit more in depth. So this is where the prohibition against eating the gid hanasheh comes from. The gid hanasheh is a sinew that runs through the hind quarters of an animal, of a cow or whatever. They call it the sciatic nerve. The gid hanasheh itself is not a tasty piece of meat. It's a sinew, which is generally tough. It's not something which is usually eaten anyway. And in fact, it may not have too much of a taste in the first place. However, the meat that surrounds that sinew also has prohibitions attached to it. Also does. Would you like to sit? Sit over here. The meat that is around it also has prohibition, because it's so close to the Gid HaNasheh. Like everything else, of course, whenever we have any kind of prohibition, we always are cautioned to stay further away from it so we don't get too close to it. So there is a rabbinic prohibition against eating the meat that surrounds the Gid HaNasheh, which is why in America the practice is typically we do not eat the hindquarters of even a slaughtered animal. Even a kosher animal that is slaughtered and everything is fine with the animal, the hindquarters is sold to non-Jews, because in America we don't do, it's not typical to do nikur. Nikur means the process of removing from the hindquarters those parts that are prohibited. In Israel, they do nikur. They remove those parts that are prohibited, which is why in Israel one can find kosher sirloin steak.
Huh.
Because sirloin steak is from the hindquarter of the animal.
They do that in France too.
Okay. Yeah. In America, I don't know of any kosher organization that does it. It could be that you could find someone that does, but typically you can't get it in America because they just don't bother with it. It's either not worth the expense or it's too complicated. They just don't bother with it. They just take the hindquarters and give it off to the non-Jews, and that's that. And they just deal with the other part of the animal for kosher meat. But in Israel, you can get kosher sirloin steak because the part that is prohibited has been removed, and the rest is, of course, okay. So this is the source of that prohibition of the Gid HaNasheh. It is from this episode of Yaakov with the angel, because that is where the angel touched Yaakov on the hip socket and made him lame, and therefore we don't eat it. There is a discussion in the Gemara whether this verse, verse 33, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, therefore the Jews don't eat from the Gid HaNasheh, whether that was, whether this verse, let me give a little bit of an introduction. The Torah is written in the order that Hashem told Moshe to write the Torah. However, the Torah is not always chronological. So Hashem may have told Moshe to write down, instead of writing down A, B, C, I want you to write A, C, B. And write it in the wrong order. Sometimes that's the case. And whenever that happens, of course, we have to ask why Hashem told Moshe to write it out of order. There is a difference of opinion in the Gemara whether this verse is not chronological. Meaning, did the Gid HaNasheh become prohibited right away to the children of Yaakov, meaning right then the tribes could not eat from the Gid HaNasheh, or did it only become prohibited later after the Torah was given? The only thing is that Hashem told Moshe to write it over here and not later on, because this is the source of the prohibition, so it makes sense to write it over here so we can all see the connection between the episode and the prohibition. So that's a discussion in the Gemara. Be that as it may, certainly from the time of the giving of the Torah and on, the Gid HaNasheh becomes prohibited. This battle between Yaakov and the angel, we've already spoken about for several weeks, how crucial and central this is to our history and to the whole history of the struggle between Yaakov and Esav. We talked about how it went through the night and how that corresponds to the very long exile, which is compared to the night, and how in the end there will be victory for Yaakov. Although it is not a clear-cut victory, Yaakov knocks down the angel. Instead, he just doesn't let him go, and it's kind of like, by default, Yaakov wins the battle. We spoke about that. Whenever there is a very significant event, we know that we Jews commemorate it in order to remember the event and incorporate whatever it is that event is meant to teach us into our lives. Pesach, we observe. That's when we left Egypt. that has a significant impact on our lives, and we commemorate it. Shavuos, we observe, that's when we receive the Torah. We just had Rosh Hashanah, that's when the world was created. All these things, Yom Kippur is about to come. These things are all ways of tapping into what happened in the past. Here, with this battle between Yaakov and Esav, which was as important as it was, there is no event on the calendar that signifies it, that reminds us of it. There's no holiday called the third day of whatever month in order to remember this battle between Yaakov and Esav. So how are we reminded of the battle? The Gid Anasha becomes that which symbolizes the battle. That's what ends up happening. It is striking that the way we remember it is by not eating the Gid Hanasha. I think that if this battle were over, and before Pasuk Lama Gimel, before that verse was written, if Hashem would have put it out for a vote and said to us, how would you like to remember this battle? What would be an effective way of remembering the battle? I think some of us might have voted for eating the Gid Hanasha, right? Have a Gid Hanasha feast to remember that this battle of Yaakov and the angel. But instead, it expresses itself as a prohibition against eating the Gid Hanasha. Why would that be? Why is it that it's expressed as a prohibition instead of a commandment? On Pesach, we eat the matzah. We don't say, don't eat the matzah because the Jews ate matzah as slaves and we don't want to be slaves, so don't eat the matzah. Or don't eat the maror because the Jews had a bitter time and we don't want bitterness, so don't eat the maror. No, we do eat the maror to remind ourselves of the bitterness. That's what we do. Here, why would it be that the way it finds expression in our lives is not eating the Gid Hanasha?
Would it be similar to not saying do unto others as opposed to not do unto others what you would not want done to you?
Okay, so you're right. This is in the negative. Don't do, right? Mm-hmm. Correct. But why?
It's connected to what we got in all the food from the beginning. With Yitzhak saying, go, kill something, they come back and make the stew, and then the plot thickened and all that.
The stew thickened. Okay. So it's connected. Here's another food related thing. We've had, really, it all goes back to the stew.
To me, the entire religion was connected.
To us men, that's a good thing. The truth is, it goes back to the lentil soup that Yaakov made for his father, which is how he got the birthright in the first place. And then you go on to the stew or the food that Esav was told to prepare for the blessing, which Yaakov then prepared instead, or Rivka prepared instead, etc. Okay, so here you have another food-related item in that story. Okay?
Somehow I related to, maybe fasting.
Okay.
You're denying yourself something. And in that way, I don't know how to connect the dots, but
okay, good.
So we go from there to some place, and I'm not sure.
All right. Well, it's taking us towards Yom Kippur, so that's good. That's good.
It's reminding us of a negative thing, really. Yaakov's weakness. I also don't know how to connect it to. Well, it doesn't want, we don't want to be reminded of his weakness, because when we're weak, our enemies will, take over.
Okay.
Control. I don't know.
Okay.
So we don't want to do something to remind, I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I keep always focusing on that Yaakov limped when he went away. And to me that sort of means that it wasn't a completed act that just took place and that was that.
Okay.
It sort of carried.
Okay. He didn't come out unscathed. Mm-hmm. We have battles in our history where the Torah reports to us that no Jew was lost. Every single soldier came back from the battle and there were no casualties. We have such events in our history. This one doesn't doesn't speak to us in that way. It's not like Yaakov emerges clearly victorious, clearly without any pain or suffering from this battle. Yaakov does suffer in more ways than one. Number one is that it takes the entire night. It's a night-long battle, which leaves him battle-weary. And as we know, since it symbolizes the Gullus, symbolizes the exile, it leaves us with a very long exile, which we are currently in the middle of. And moreover, he comes out in pain. The angel does manage to harm him, to wound him. We spoke about how the Gid HaNasheh, or the hip, which is what everything rests on, is symbolic of those who support the Torah. And we spoke about how at the end of the exile, that those who support the Torah would be challenged, and that there would be that's where Esav's attempt at hurting Yaakov would focus on those who support the Torah rather than those who actually are studying the Torah itself. We spoke about that in the past. Let's read these psukim one more time. starting from Lamed Aleph 31. Yaakov called the place Peniel, for I saw Elohim face to face, and my soul was saved. Yaakov saw angels all the time. Yaakov, in fact, had angels at his beck and call. As we know from the beginning of Vayishlach, that he sent angels as his messengers ahead to Esav. Yaakov was...
But he didn't fight them.
He didn't fight them. But he says, I saw Elohim face to face, and my soul was saved. What is he so enamored with? It's nothing. I mean, he's seen many angels.
But it doesn't say angel. It says the divine.
It says the divine. It says Elohim. I mean, he's referring to the angel, of course.
Right. Okay.
But you're right. You're right. And really, what Mrs. Kaiser said is also correct. He didn't fight with angels before. Mm-hmm. What does the name Elohim always connote, as we've said in the past?
Judgment.
Judgment.
Oh, so
as opposed to mercy. I saw Elohim. I saw God's judgment face to face. I came face to face with judgment, not with mercy. And I was saved. I was saved from the pure judgment of God. That's what he's saying. I saw Elohim face to face, and my soul was saved. I was pitted against the angel of Esav that represented this din, this judgment. And in the end, I was saved. I didn't come out unscathed, but I was saved. Again, this definitely has parallels to Yom Kippur. We've just come out of Rosh Hashanah, where we were face to face with Din, with judgment, and now we're moving into Rachamim, into mercy for Yom Kippur. But we did come face to face with God as well in His judgment. So he called it Peniel. Now the fact that he calls it a name means what? Okay, so it's obviously significant. You don't call a name, you don't give this table a name. This is a table. You don't say this table name is, you know, Greg.
What side was he on? Wasn't he at a point where one side was Israel? And
he had been on the side that was not Israel. That's what he had said. He had gone back across the river.
Okay.
Crossing out of Israel, what would later be Israel, that's where he had the battle.
And that's where he made the name.
That's correct.
Wasn't he concerned, I don't know where it was, that maybe somewhere along the line he had sinned and God wouldn't do part of it?
Well, it's true that he was concerned about that before, and that's why he prayed before he met up with Esav. Even though God had guaranteed him that he'd be safe, but he prayed because he was afraid that perhaps he had sinned.
So would that, this part of the that he wasn't judged, he hadn't sinned? And
if he has, it wasn't enough to destroy him. It was only enough to hurt him.
Okay. And where is the connection where, you know, we're told time and again that Hashem, no matter what happens, what kind of crazy or horrible things happen to the Jewish people, that we're going to survive. Is there a correlation between that?
Yeah.
And this is in the Yaakov.
Yeah. Because he's representing the Jewish people over here. He's representing the Jews throughout history. This nighttime battle, this throughout the night battle, is the history of the Jewish people until the coming of Mashiach. That's what we spoke about before, and his surviving, that means that we are always survived. There are other references to our survival, but this is certainly symbolic of it. So he calls it Peniel. That means that it is a significant place, because you don't name things that aren't important. Vayizrach lo Hashemesh, the sun rose for him. It's a funny way to say it. Usually you would say Vayizrach Hashemesh, the sun rose. It says the sun rose for him. Kasher avar es Penuel, when he passed Penuel. Now that's a little bit funny also. If I am in Atlanta, and I name the place Atlanta, I'm standing there, and I name it Atlanta, and then I leave Atlanta and walk on to Savannah. Would you say that I passed Atlanta? You wouldn't say I passed Atlanta. You would say that I
left.
Well, you wouldn't even say I passed through. I left. He was there and he left. Yeah. But it says that the sun rose from when he passed Penuel.
He was in Penuel.
Huh?
He was in Penuel.
He was there.
Maybe he didn't pass it.
He left it.
Okay. You're saying that the name changed a little bit. Maybe it's a different place. Okay. Okay. Yeah. It's possible. V'utzolea al yirecho, and he is limping on his hip. It's interesting that the Torah has not yet told us that he's limping. Before, the Torah told us that he was, the angel touched him on the hip, and the hip socket was knocked out of place. That the Torah told us. But no mention was made of him limping. And here, it says he is limping on his hip. And then it tells us, therefore we don't eat it. Rashi tells us that this sun rising for him, Vayizrach lo Hashemesh kasher avar es Penuel, the sun rose for him when he passed Penuel, was making up for the time when the sun set prematurely. Here, the sun rises prematurely, because there was a time in the not too distant past, in our learning here, that the sun had set prematurely. When was that?
When he was
Lavan back. Okay. When he was going to Lavan, and he was in the place of the Beis HaMikdash, and he was going to go right past it, or he went past it and came back to it, depending on the Medrash. And at that time, Hashem made the sun come down quickly in order that Yaakov should sleep in that place, so that he would have the dream of the ladder and the angels going up and down the ladder. And we pointed out then that the way it reads, the way the verse reads over there, also implies it happening prematurely, because it says, I'll just read it to you, it says, Vayalen Sham Kiva Hashemesh. He slept there before the sun had set. Instead of saying, the sun set, so he went to sleep, it says he slept there before the sun had set. The implication is the sun set when he wasn't expecting it to set, so therefore he had to lie down over there. So there the sun set prematurely, so that he would have the dream. Here, the sun rises prematurely. When the sun set over there prematurely, where was Yaakov going? He was going into Galus. He was going into exile. From Israel to Lavan, into Galus. Here, this is his return. When he left, it set prematurely. The implication being that the Galus would happen prematurely. But when it was time for the Galus to end, the sun rose on his behalf. It also rose prematurely. We know that when this galus does end, it will end so suddenly and so surprisingly that it will shock everyone. Any kinds of predictions or delving into it, that's why I always discourage the practice of trying to figure out maybe what's happening now is a sign for Mashiach to come and all that. There's nothing gained by that type of speculation. Because you can be sure of one thing. We are not sure of anything. with the coming of Mashiach. We're not sure when it will be. We're not sure how it will be. We're not sure who it will be. We don't know what the circumstances will be. We don't know which country the Jews will be in. We don't know anything about that. Well, we know one thing, that everyone will be shocked. That we know. We do know that no one is going to figure it out. It's going to happen. So that is also symbolized over here. The sun rose prematurely. The way that Mashiach is going to come, the way the Galus will end, will be so sudden that it will be a complete surprise and shock. And that's implied over here with the sun rising for him. But the other thing the sun does when it rises for him is it heals the limp. That heals his limp. And that also is implied, that implies also that the end of the gullus will also end the limp. So now, we learned before that the battle between Yaakov and Esav's angel is symbolic of the gullus. So therefore, it would stand to reason that when the angel leaves, the gullus is over. But apparently not. And this is important. Apparently, there's a lingering effect of the gullus. Yes, the angel has let go of Yaakov. Yes, Yaakov is no longer in mortal peril. The angel has departed. However, he's still limping. There's still pain. He's not healed. He's not whole. The Jewish people are not complete. Yaakov, who represents all the Jewish people, we refer to ourselves as being parts of Yaakov. Yaakov represents all the Jewish people, but he is incomplete. There is a group or an area of Jews that is not healed, and the sun rises prematurely to heal that limp, to heal that pain.
Where do you see that? Because it doesn't really.
No, it doesn't say. It doesn't say. The Gemara tells us that when it rose, it healed the limp. That's right.
Well, when the sun rose prematurely, is Yaakov in Israel now? Has he already?
I imagine, because it says that it's the sun rose for him when he passed Penuel. I think this is speculative, but I think that the reason why he uses the word avar, to pass, is because that's also the term you use for crossing a river. Because he had to go back across the river. He had to cross Yabok to go to back for the Pachim Ketanim, and that's where he was out of Israel and had the battle, and now he crosses back into Israel, and
so he's no longer in exile.
Right.
And all the Jewish people have already crossed.
Right. It all comes together. Right.
Is he healed before he
crossed? I don't know. I don't know exactly when it happened. The way we know that he's completely healed is that later on, if you want to turn two pages ahead to 180, this is after he meets up with Esav. It says on page 180 in Pasuk Yudches 18, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem. Yaakov comes intact to the city of Shechem, and Rashi tells us that he was intact in many ways. One of the ways he was intact was that he was healed from his limp.
But we don't, back here, we don't know.
That's correct. The Gemara says that the sun had healing powers that contributed to the healing of Yaakov. But you're right, it doesn't necessarily mean he was healed immediately. It could be that it took time, because the verse says he is limping on his hip.
Wasn't he owed that earlier sun rising because of the earlier evening?
Yes. Yeah. Then, I mean, it didn't have to happen. You can say he was owed, but
Nothing got wasted. Everything needs to be.
I once attended a class. One of my mentors in yeshiva, he was in Kola when I was a bacher. His name is Rabbi Usher Eisenberger. He now lives in Detroit. He's a Rav in Detroit. So one time he gave a class in his home. And what he did is he documented every place in Tanakh where you find, and in Gemara, where you find the sun set earlier or rose earlier, or the sun stood still, or the moon stood still, all those things. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to suggest that it all works out in the end, that each one has a correlating opposite effect.
Right. So the laws of nature are preserved.
Right. That's what he was doing in that class. I can't tell you, remember every detail of that, but that's what he did.
So it's a hypothesis. Some of your old Jews just think the sun will perfect the people before Mashiach comes.
I don't know. I can't say for sure what the exact, because it hasn't happened yet, so I can't tell you for sure.
You said the end of the Golos will end the Lent, and that's what you mean. Right?
Yeah, but I can't tell you whether Mrs. Starkman is trying to pin it down to exactly when, right? And then I can't say there is a correlation between the two, but I can't say. I think it is important to note that when it says he's limping, it doesn't say he was limping. It says in the present tense, "V'hutso leya al yirecho," he is limping on his hip. I think it is important that Torah is drawing our attention to this limp. The Torah is making it clear to us that we are limping on our hip. V'hutso leya al yirecho, Yaakov, who we represent, or he represents us, is limping on his hip. It's true it will be healed, but the way we need to think about it is that we are currently limping. The Tomchei Torah, those who hold up the Jewish people, are limping, are in pain. And the not eating of the Gid Hanasha is the way that we keep that in mind, that is kept in the forefront of our minds. It's not meant to be something we forget about. It's something that we do need to keep in mind and be aware of, that this limp is real, it affects us, and it is important because the way that we conduct ourselves is different if we're limping or if we're not limping. It's important to know that we are somewhat handicapped as Jews. That will change when Mashiach comes. But we do have a little bit of a handicap in our ability to walk. We are limping. And that is a significant point for Jews to remember throughout the exile. We don't have all of our capacity to do all that we can do.
And that is in the spiritual sense?
Yes, in the spiritual sense. That's right, in the spiritual sense. Now, this is actually very, very interesting. Look in Lamed Gimel, 33, and tell me two words that are used in Lamed Gimel that are used throughout the Torah, but this is the first place you find it. B'nei Yisrael. B'nei Yisrael, you know, we are called the B'nei Yisrael, that's who we are. This is the very first time you find the words B'nei Yisrael. Now, of course, it's the first time you find the words B'nai Yisrael. That's because Yaakov's name was Yaakov. Only a few verses ago, he was told that it would be changed to Yisrael. It wasn't actually changed yet. But he was told that it would be changed to Yisrael. And now, the phrase B'nai Yisrael is used. Later, we'll find that the phrase B'nai Yaakov is used. When would the Torah use the phrase B'nai Yaakov? And when would the Torah use the phrase B'nai Yisrael? Later we're going to find that the Torah refers to the 12 sons of Yaakov as the B'nai Yaakov. So when would the Torah use B'nai Yisrael? When would the Torah use B'nai Yaakov?
Maybe one weaker,
one stronger, one stronger. What do you want to say?
I would think after Sinai.
Just to say with Moshe.
Okay. When the Torah is referring to the Jewish people, it's B'nai Yisrael. When it's referring to the sons of Yaakov, it's B'nai Yaakov. B'nai Yisrael, it becomes a term that refers to the people, whether the people be only 12, because of the sons of Yaakov, or whether the people be millions, as we are today. The B'nai Yisrael is the term for the Jewish people as a whole. B'nai Yaakov are referring to the children of Yaakov, as if you talk about anybody's children, you say the children of whoever it is.
But
not
his name's been changed.
No one said the same thing?
We are saying the same thing.
Okay. His name, first of all, his name has not been changed yet. The angel was just telling Yaakov that the name will be changed.
Will be changed.
That's number one. Number two is that even after Yaakov's name is changed to Yisrael,
it's not changed
the same way as Avram was changed to Avraham. Avram is changed to Avraham to the point where the Gemara says that if you call him Avram instead of Avraham, there's a prohibition. You're not allowed to do that. You're allowed to talk about the name Avram being changed to Avraham, but you can't call him by the name Avram anymore because he's been changed to Avraham. Sarai is not Sarai anymore. She is Sarah. But Yaakov, even though his name is going to be changed to Yisrael, the name Yaakov is not discarded. What's that?
Why?
Why is it not discarded?
Spiritual versus physical.
Well, there's many, many explanations given for when one is used and when the other is used, but the why is going to be because the name Yaakov still has relevance. You see, the name Avram is the same as Avraham, only less. It's without the hay. So, he the way Rashi says it is, Avram is he was the father to the nation of Aram. Avraham is Av Hamon Goyim, he's the father of many nations. Sarah and Sarai. Sarai means my princess, which means that she's only the princess of Avraham and his local area. Sarah means princess of everybody, of the whole world. So the Sarai is the same as Sarah, only less. Yaakov and Yisrael are not the same thing. They're completely two completely different names. One has one connotation, one has another connotation. So when the name is changed, it's not that the other one is discarded, it's that he gains a name. We are known by the Yisrael name, which is the more...
No, we say Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, not Yisrael.
What's that?
We say Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, not Yisrael.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. I can't tell you why in that particular place. There are other places where it says Avram Yitzchak v'Yisrael Avosenu.
Really?
Yeah, not in Shemot Esrei. But there's a pasuk that says Avram Yitzchak v'Yisrael Avosenu. Shem Razos Le'olam. In Ovalot Zion we say it. We say Avram Yitzchak v'Yisrael Avosenu. So we do find the usage of Yisrael as his name. But I can't tell you why in each place, this time it says Yaakov, that time it says Yisrael. That there are many who attempt to do that. It's one of those things where you have so many different times the names are used, it's very hard to come up with a rule that's going to take care of every single case.
Oh, so there isn't a rule of what, that Yaakov refers to such and such, and Yisrael refers to such and such?
There are definitely rules. I don't know.
There isn't one thing that carries through.
Well, you can always poke holes in it. You know, there's so, because there's so many. You know, as if there are only six times, then you could figure out it. You know, it's very easy to
nothing
figure out.
Through all of them.
Well, I'm sure they do, but you have to explain them. They're always going to have questions. You have to explain why that's an exception, and you know.
They're both holy.
Others had many names. Moshe Rabbeinu had 10 names, but Moshe is his main name. But he had other names as well. Yisroel had 7 names, right? Yisroel is the main name, but he has other names as well. The names are all significant, and they all speak of a certain aspect of the person. So here, Yaakov, here the term B'nai Yisrael is used for the first time, and this is that the nation Yisrael does not eat the Gid Hanasha. The pasuk continues. Aleph. Vayisa Yaakov Einav, Yaakov lifted up his eyes, Vayar V'hine Esav Ba, and he saw, and behold, Esav is coming, V'imo arba me'os ish, and with him are 400 men. Now remember, when Yaakov first found out about the 400 men, what does it immediately tell us Yaakov was?
Scared.
That was the very next thing it says. Vayira Yaakov mo. Yaakov was very scared. He's not scared anymore. Why not?
He
defeated the angel. He survived the angel. What's that?
Isn't that what Yisrael means? That he
Yeah. So he understands that he's going to be safe. And as we said, that now we don't find that he has separated the camp anymore. Now they're all together. Rather than separating the camp, which when he was preparing for war, now there is no separation of the camp, as we said before, because once he has defeated the angel, then there's no need to separate the camp. Vayachatz es ha'iladim, and he divided up the children, al Leah ve'al Rachel, on Leah and on Rachel, ve'al shetei ha'shefachos, and on the two maids, which means he had each of the children go to their respective mothers. So Leah had her six children, and Rachel had her one child, because Binyamin had not yet been born, and Bilhah and Zilpah had each of their two children. Vayasem es ha'shefachos ves yaldei hen rishona, he placed the maids and their children first, ves Leah viladeha acharonim, and Leah and her children last, ves Rachel ves Yosef acharonim, and Rachel and Yosef last. How do you have two lasts?
In the English translation,
it says next.
What does it say?
It says next.
Next. Okay. We know the phrase that is often used, especially in school settings, is acharon, acharon, chaviv. The later that you are is more precious. It's derived from here. It is not by accident that Chazal, that our sages, wrote Acharon, Acharon, Chaviv. Instead of, why don't they just write Acharon, Chaviv? Last is precious. But that's not what they wrote. They wrote Acharon, Acharon, Chaviv. Last, last, or later, later is precious. It's because they got it from here. And here the word Acharon is used twice. Once for Leah and her children, once for Rachel and her son. So both are precious. You can't have them both be last, but they're each precious. The further back you go, you encounter more precious. Yes.
However, it could have said, it could have, I mean, the card does that all the time, could have mentioned all the names of Leah's children.
It could have. So why does it mention Yosef specifically?
Because it's only Yosef.
I mean, it could have said and Rachel and her son.
Right. So it could have said...
It's like the main character here.
Yeah. Okay. So it is drawing our attention to Yosef. And you are correct that he is the main character. Of all of the tribes, when it comes to fighting Esav or defeating Esav, Yosef is the main character. That is correct, as we're going to see in a few psukim if we get to it tonight.
That's why they left after he was born.
That's right. That's right. After Yosef was born at Laban's house, then Yaakov was ready to prepare to leave. It took him another 6 years, but that's when he was prepared to leave.
So Yosef is only six?
At this point, he is 6 years old. That's right. That's right.
Is it significant that the order is different? And first it says that he divided them among Leah, Rachel, and the two handmaids, and then afterwards the orders get switched.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the Torah is telling us that he deliberately put them in this order. It didn't just happen that way. Why the first pasuk says Leah first, then Rachel, then the Shvachas, I don't know. But you're right. V'hu avar lifnehem, he passed in front of them. V'yishtachu arza sheva pe'amim, and he bowed to the ground 7 times. Ad gishto, ad achiv, until his brother. Vayaratz Esav likraso vayachavekehu, and Esav ran to greet him, and he hugged him. Vayipolatz avarav, vayishakehu, and he fell on his neck, and he kissed him. Vayivku, and they cried. So rather than fighting, Esav cries on Yaakov's shoulder, on his neck. Vayisah Esainav, one more pasuk. Vayisah Esainav, he lifted up his eyes. Esav lifted up his eyes. Vayaris Hanashim Es Hailadim, and he saw the wives and the children. Vayomer, and he said, Mi Eilelach, who are these to you? Who are these people? What are they doing here with you? Vayomar, and he said, Hailadim, the children, Asher Hanan Elokim Es Abdecha, that God has graciously given to your servant. Does he say Asher Hanan Hashem es avdecha? He says Asher Hanan Elokim es avdecha. This is going to be a recurring theme, which we're not going to be able to develop fully tonight, so we're going to have to leave it for next time. But we're going to find that Yaakov is going to invoke the name of Elokim repeatedly as he talks to Esav. Why does he do that?
Reminding him.
Is that how
Asaph? Well, Asaph wouldn't have survived with pure judgment, but he may have judged other people. That could be. But Yaakov is going to be constantly making clear to Asaph that watched. I've been under judgment. I've been under the scrutiny, the strict scrutiny of God, and I'm still here, and I've got my sons. And don't think that there's any mercy going on over here. Don't think that you can find some way of saying to Hashem, hey, Yaakov doesn't deserve this. Yaakov is not, doesn't, he really should be this. Esav, I've been under the strict scrutiny of God, and this is what I have.
But at that point, he's healed from the hip, though. He's healed.
Well, as we said, I'm not sure whether he was healed 100% yet or it's going to happen later, but he's...
Was Esav asking about the women because he was attracted to them? Because he doesn't answer about the women. He only says, he sort of like avoids that topic.
Esav seems to have been asking, even though it says he saw the women and the children, it seems that from Yaakov's answer, that Esav really wanted to know about the children. Because they are the heirs to Yaakov. Now, Yaakov's continuing in the world is through his children. Those are the Bnei Yisrael. Esav wants to know, what's with this Bnei Yisrael business? Who are these people?
He said he was really supposed to have married Leah, which everything was like, so he could have been thinking,
He could have been, although, as we're going to see, he was really interested in Rachel, as we're about to see.
Yeah, she was hiding. Wasn't she being...
No.
Dina.
No,
Yosef was protecting her in the back.
Yeah. Let's read the next two verses, and then we're going to talk about this a little bit. Vatigashna ha-shefachos, and the maids came close. Hena v'yaldehen, they and their sons, v'yishtachavena, and they bowed down. Vatigash gam Leah v'yiladeha v'yishtachavu, and Leah also and her sons came close and bowed down. The acharon afterwards, Nigash Yosef Rachel, Yosef and his and Rachel came close, Vayishtachavu, and they bowed down. And our sages stop on this point that it lists all the mothers before their children, except for Yosef, 6-year-old Yosef, who is listed before his mother Rachel. Rashi tells us in the name of Chazal, because Yosef said, "My mother is beautiful. And this Russia may look at my mother and be interested in her. I will stand in front of my mother and I will stand as tall as I can to obstruct Esav's view of my mother." Now,
6 years he understood what it is.
That's right.
Sam is 3 years
old. Now.
My mother.
Now, what does this mean? He's obstructing the view of his mother. Was Yosef taller than his mother at 6 years old? It is possible. Okay. It is possible. Is that necessarily the case? Do we have to say that Yosef was taller than his mother?
No.
What was Yosef doing when he stood in front of his mother?
Protecting. From Esau.
Yes, also.
But how is he obstructing the view of Esav if he's not taller than his mother?
It's why it symbolizes.
He's like a shield.
He's like a shield? It's a little more than that. You have to have a man to really appreciate this.
He couldn't see all of her, right?
What's that? He couldn't see all of her. Yosef is throwing down the gauntlet. Yosef is saying to Esav, "Don't you look at my mother." That's what he's doing. He's standing in front of his mother. And as Esav is looking towards his mother, Yosef is looking him directly in the eye. Right. That's right. That's what Yosef is doing. That's what Yosef is doing. He's saying, don't even think about it.
He's being territorial.
That's what he's doing. That's what Yosef is doing. That's what he's doing over here. He's right? That's what he's doing. He may have been taller than his mother, yeah, but that's irrelevant. What he's doing is he's making sure that Esav understands that he's not going near his mother. And that obstructs his view. Because when he's looking at Rachel, he sees this Yosef. And Yosef is making it clear to Esav, "I'm not afraid of you. And you stay away from her." That's what's happening here. Now, Yosef gets a tremendous bracha for what he does over here. Normally, we don't encourage such behavior. Normally, we would say that sort of behavior is it's a little haughty. It's...
natural.
What's that?
Not true.
Yes. Yeah, right. It's brazen, right? A little chutzpah. We don't usually encourage such behavior. But in this case, Yosef is given a tremendous bracha for what he does. And the reason is because he should have been afraid of Esav. Esav was not some meek, mild-mannered guy. Asaph was a known warrior. He was a powerful, powerful man. And he was the kind of person that most people would back away from if he would challenge them. And Yosef says, I don't care. He's not going near my mother. And he stands there and obstructs his vision. So Yosef is given a tremendous bracha. And the bracha he's given is Alei Ayin. As we're going to see later, many months from now, in Parshas Vayechi, he's given the bracha of being above the eye. Because Yosef obstructs the eye of Esav. He doesn't allow the eye of Esav to look at his mother. And so he is given the bracha that the evil eye cannot affect him. Now you'll say, what does the evil eye mean? The evil eye, well, people talk about the evil eye, ayin hara, that sort of thing. Ayin hara means jealousy. That's what it is. Ayin hara is jealousy. We are told that jealousy can harm a person. If someone is jealous of me, it can harm me. If I am jealous of someone else, it can harm that person. Because we've spoken about this in the past, maybe already a couple of years ago, but that what jealousy does is it makes Hashem revisit whether the person deserves what he has. Because if I have something and I flaunt it and I cause others to be jealous of me, then Hashem says, well, one second, does he really deserve it? That's what the evil eye is. That's what ayin hara is. And when a person causes others to be jealous, then Hashem scrutinizes that person of whether he really deserves what he has. Because Yosef was willing to literally stick his neck out and stand in the face of Esav over here, he is given the bracha of being above the eye, of being immune to the evil eye. And everybody is not immune to it except for Yosef and his descendants. Yosef and his descendants cannot be damaged by the ayin hara, by the evil eye. And that's because of this episode. And that perhaps we can speak about more in the future. I want to turn back now, in the last few minutes we have, to Yaakov approaching his brother. And it says in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, on page 176, V'hu avar lifneihem, he passed in front of them, v'yishtachu artza sheva palamim, and he bowed to the ground 7 times, ad gishto, until he reached ad achiv, until his brother. I heard this from one of my rebbeim in Baltimore in Neri Yisrael, of Kalman Weinreb, and it's not his own. I do not remember from whom he was saying this. But the verse here has an extra word. Ad gishto, ad achiv. Until he reached, until his brother. The word until is repeated. The word ad is repeated. It should say, ad gishto, le'achiv, or el achiv, until he reached to his brother. But ad gishto ad achiv means until he reached, until his brother. So that's redundant. And why does it say it that way? So he said, because, you know, Yaakov and his brother Esav, there was bad blood between them. This is 20 years old, this friction between them. And Yaakov knows that his brother hates him. And Yaakov wants to have shalom. He wants to have peace. But it's very difficult to have peace when you know someone hates you. And it's very difficult to love someone who you know does not love you. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Kemayim panim el panim, kein lev ha'adam l'adam, something like that. The way that you look into water, before mirrors, you look into water and see your face, the water reflects your face back at you. So too, the heart of one person to another. If I project to you a heart of dislike, of acrimony, then you will reflect that back to me. When I send out vibes of dislike, that will mean that you will likely dislike me as well. It's very hard to overcome that. But if I send out to you clear indications that I am fond of you, you will likely be fond of me. That's a very common thing. That's why, you know, when you meet someone for the first time, there's a big difference. The impression you get of a person the first time you meet them, if you meet someone and smile at them, your impression of them will almost always be favorable because they'll probably smile at you. And then you think, oh, they're a friendly person. If you meet someone and you don't smile, and the person will naturally not smile back, very often you will walk away with a negative impression of the person. They don't really like me. They didn't really want to talk to me. You get that kind of feeling. Because people reflect what they see and what they feel. Yaakov had been feeling animosity towards his brother. And he didn't want there to be animosity. So it says that Yaakov went before them. He bowed to the ground 7 times. Ad Gishto, until he reached Ad Achiv, to the point where he saw Esav no longer as his enemy Esav, but he saw him as his brother. Ad Gishto, till he reached until his brother. He got to the point through his bowing down and getting up and bowing down and getting up and bowing down and getting up and bowing. He was able to internalize the fact, this is my brother. I don't want war. I don't want to fight. I don't want to have animosity. I want him to be my brother. When Esav saw that, Vayaratz Esav likraso vayachabakehu, Esav ran to greet him and hugged him, vayipolat savarav vayishalkehu, and he fell on his neck and he kissed him, vayivku, and they cried. And I want to read to you what Rashi says over here. And this is a crucial Rashi. Amar of Shimon ben Yochai. Rav Shimon ben Yochai says, halachahi, it is a law. It's not just a well-known fact, it is a law. She'esav soni liyakov. Esav hates Yaakov. That's the way it is. Ella shenichmeru racham of ba'osa shah, but his mercy was evoked at that time. V'nashko b'chol libo, and he kissed him with all his heart. Even Esav loved Yaakov at that moment. The love did not last. They end up parting, and we know that Esav hates us today. We know that there's animosity. But at that moment, there was love between Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov managed to overcome his animosity to Esav, and Esav responded with a true love for Yaakov. And he literally cried in love on Yaakov's shoulders. He kissed him and they cried.
What's the significance of 7 times?
You can make the connections in 7, but that's a complete thing. I just want to, before we'll get to questions in a moment, I just want to point out, the end of the Golus, as it comes to a close, seems to bring about a reconciliation, a true reconciliation between Esav and Yaakov. Then in the end, there is some sort of reconciliation. We know that part of Mashiach coming is that the saviors will go up on the mountain of Zion to judge the mountain of Esav. That we're going to defeat Esav. There's going to be subservience. But in some way, there seems to be some reconciliation that is going to happen. How it's going to happen, I can't tell you. When it's going to happen, I can't tell you. But there does seem to be something that is being symbolized over here with the end of the Golus. It is also worthwhile noting, as we come close to Yom Kippur, and we know that one of the most difficult things to do is to go to someone who we know we have wronged and ask them for mechila, and ask them to forgive us. That's always so difficult. And we know that we have had friction with people throughout the year. We know that there are people that we do need to ask mechila from, we do need to ask forgiveness from. It's very, very difficult to do. One of the main reasons why it's difficult is because we're afraid that the other person is not going to accept what we have to say. If we would know for a fact that when I go to that person and I beg forgiveness, the person will say to me, oh, of course, I really feel bad also. And we hug each other and we say, oh, it's wonderful. If I would know at the outset that was going to happen, then going to ask for mechila would be a no-brainer. Of course I would want to do it. Why wouldn't I want to do it? Wouldn't I want to make a new friend? Wouldn't that be what I want? But I'm afraid it's not going to happen. And that's why it's very, very difficult to do. One of the strategies in being able to do it effectively is what Yaakov did over here. It's to internalize the fact, this is my friend. This is someone who I want to have a relationship with. This is someone who I want to remove the animosity from, and I want him to be my brother. I want her to be my sister, whatever it is. In doing so, you increase the probability that their response to you will be positive as well. Questions?
Well, you know, you said, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says that he really kissed him with sincerity. But then we know that it's also known that it was with like a bite. Yeah,
Rav Shimon Bar Yochai disagrees. He says it was a real...
Yeah. That was Rashi. Yeah.
There's different midrashim.
I know. He also known that.
Right. He says that this was a complete.
I was supposed to ask for. That was Esau. I'm sorry. I was supposed to ask also non-Jews.
You don't need to do that. No. You don't need to do that. There's nothing wrong with doing that. But the main thing is to go to your fellow Jew. Yeah. Okay. We should all have a gemar chasima tova. We should be sealed for life.
Thank you.
For you.